So welcome to the Action for Happiness podcast. Our guest today is Claire Kelly, and she's part of the core team and director of content and training at the Mindfulness in Schools project. This is a group that's pioneering mindfulness at all levels of academia, from nursery, primary, secondary, all the way up to universities. We talked with Claire about some of the highlights of 2015 and some of the results that they're starting to see. We also talk about the largest research project ever involving mindfulness and young people. This includes 8 universities and schools all over the UK, you know, like Oxford, Cambridge and UCL, where we're already starting to see benefits such as how students deal with pressures of exams, performance anxiety, confidence, managing their own emotions. Talk about being the change that you want to see. You know, if you really want to make a difference, it really starts with educating the children. So I hope you enjoy this one. All right, so Claire, thanks again for joining Anne and I. And Claire, you're the operations director for the Mindfulness in School project. We last spoke on episode 30 of the Renaissance podcast. So for the listeners out there, please go check that out at renaissancepodcast.com, where we talk a bit about your personal journey, you know, from studying at Cambridge to working in education for over 25 years. Mm-hmm. And about your own mindfulness practice that eventually led you to pursue helping others, you know, helping students to be more mindful.
Mm-hmm.
So the Mindfulness in Schools project, you know, doing amazing work in educating both students and teachers to be mindful and leading the way in bringing this, you know, hopefully into the curriculum on a greater scale.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought we'd begin with, Claire, if you could give us a high-level introduction to the Mindfulness in Schools project. And what I'd really like to get into is perhaps talk about some of the highlights and some of the learning lessons from 2015, and then we could just take it from there.
Sure, okay. So just a kind of an overview of what Mindfulness in Schools project does. We have developed 3 curricula, classroom-based curricula, so really working in schools, not surprisingly, but also with organisations who are related to education. So most of our work is in developing content and also training teachers to deliver particular mindfulness curricula for kids. And so we have something called Dot B, which was the very first 8-week course that we developed for 11 to 18-year-olds. And then now we've got Pause B, which is for 7 to 11-year-olds. Yeah. And also we've got something called Dot B Foundations, which is the course that's specifically aimed at school staff or people working in education, honouring the fact that they maybe don't have quite as much time to do a full traditional kind of MBSR course, you know, mindfulness-based stress reduction, or the more traditional 8-week courses. So we go into their schools and teach them as a group, and slightly shorter sessions, but still over 8 weeks. But as well as doing all that, we are really keen to support people who want to research mindfulness in education, and anybody who's interested in doing any of that, we sort of say, great, come, we'll advise you and help you.
Yeah.
We've been part of the consultancy group with the all-party parliamentary group, mm-hmm. For mindfulness that's been going on, and we were part of the Mindful Nation report that came out last October. Which is really exciting. There's a very big research project now grinding into action, which is funded by the Wellcome Trust, and involves about 8 different universities. So Oxford, Cambridge, UCL, Exeter, huge range of universities looking. It's probably, we think it's the largest scale research project ever done involving mindfulness and young people. And it's long overdue. I mean, that was one of the conclusions of the Mindful Nation report. Is this is all really wonderful, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of research around the benefits of mindfulness for adults. Mm-hmm. We now need is a similar amount of really solid research around kids and mindfulness, and that's exactly what the Myriad project is all about.
Mm-hmm. It'd be very difficult to get that into the schools and to, you know, to ask the government to try this out. How was that facilitated, and how has the progression been to allow research on this scale to take place?
You know what, it's funny. People say, well, it must be really hard to persuade people to go in and do it. And actually, we don't We've never ever done any direct marketing. Mm-hmm. We've only ever developed the courses, offered some training, and people have come. So there isn't any kind of barrier, as far as we can see, to getting people interested in doing it. Quite the opposite, actually. More often than not, we're in a situation where we can't meet demand. Wow. People are saying, "Come and do it here, come and do it there," and we're saying, "Well, yeah, we're still quite small. You know, we're still." You know, four men in a shed, really, and a dog. So we do our best. But what's really great is that, as well as schools saying, "Oh, please, you know, come and teach our kids," everyone is now really getting the basic principle that before you try and take mindfulness into schools for students, you've got to get the staff doing it. And that is absolutely crucial. There's no point in imposing a mindfulness curriculum on kids if the staff are exhausted, stressed, nobody in the staff really understands what it is, you know, nobody on the staff is really championing it in the school. So, you know, everyone's going out in the corridor and kicking the photocopier. It just doesn't work. So we always say, if a school comes to us and says, "Look, how do we get mindfulness into our school?" We say, "Don't worry about the students for now. Get the staff involved, you know, get them to just come and we'll come in and just talk to them about what mindfulness is and what it isn't and what the research evidence is. And if at the end of that staff want to go on and do an 8-week course, then brilliant. You know, we can come and help you, or we can suggest to other local teachers who can come in and do something." And by that stage, not only are the staff talking amongst themselves about it, but also it filters through to the parents. So we get lots of parents saying, "When can we do this course? You know, when can we start doing some mindfulness?" Yeah. And if the kids are going home going, "Oh, you know, Mum, you need to kind of calm down, your amygdala and your prefrontal cortex isn't working quite so well. This is the Pause B curriculum where they learn about the brain," you know, "or I'm going to show you a technique that will really help you calm your amygdala down." Yes. And parents are going, "Whoa, I need some of this, you know, my child has taught me it, I want to do it now." But certainly, you know, what we always say is, because of course we get schools saying to us, "That's really nice. We love the idea of doing something that's really great for well-being. But just now, you know, we're on the verge of getting a not so good report from Ofsted and we've got to get our grades up." So that's where we're focusing our attention. And our response to that would be, absolutely, completely get it. You know, I've been there. Do you believe that somebody who is anxious, struggling, not feeling particularly positive about the world, finds it difficult to focus in on positive things, finds it really easy to focus on negative things, is going to thrive and do their best in an exam? Because in a way, the two aren't, you can't separate the two out. And it's, I suppose, the next phase of my campaign, if you like, my own personal campaign, is to try and encourage schools to not see well-being and pastoral support separate from academic. Yeah. And it's funny, in schools, you know, very often you'll have an academic deputy head and a pastoral deputy head. And the two are seen as very separate things in the school. And very often the academic deputy head position is much more prestigious because it's to do with grades and results. And actually what we need to do is join them up a bit, you know, and say, "Well, look, well-being and mental health and thriving are the responsibility of everybody, not just the school counsellor or the pastoral deputy head or whoever, you know, kids get sent to if they're struggling." It has to be broader than that, a bit like safeguarding in schools. I think it needs to be everybody's responsibility. You know, everybody's understanding of what well-being looks like and everybody's understanding on some very basic things you can do to help support kids, the first being look after yourself and model it, you know.
Yes. I wanted to ask about this large-scale study involving the 8 universities that, you know, you mentioned earlier. What can you elaborate a little more on what they're trying to achieve and sort of what?
Yeah, it's quite complicated. But there are, see if I could, this is a test for me because I always get confused about what's what. So we've got three strands. The first strand, which has already begun, is headed up by UCL and Cambridge, and they are looking at the neuroscience behind mindfulness. So they're basically going to be charting a group of students who, at the beginning of their mindfulness course and at the end of their mindfulness course, and I think also slightly beyond that, to see any neurological changes, any kind of brain structure, brain function changes, because there's loads of evidence now around the different parts of the brain associated with kind of doing, thinking, planning, you know, what Mark Williams calls doing mode. Versus being mode, so the capacity to be present and use your attention in the here and now. So they're doing functional MRI scans on these poor students over a prolonged period of time. So that's the first strand. And the second strand is around, well, two things really, whether you can train a teacher to deliver mindfulness in an effective way, comparing two different versions. So one is the traditional route that we suggest, which is 8-week course, 6 months embedding your practice, then train to teach it to young people. And the other one is, another version is to do, rather than an 8-week course, do a self-taught course using the Frantic World, I don't know, Frantic World course, which is Mark Williams' book and CD. And then one day training. Do you know it?
We had Danny Penman on the podcast. Yeah.
He was one of our guests.
Yeah, so there you go. Yeah. So his course, but the self-guided one. And then potentially having a one-day training to teach the kids mindfulness, because our training is 4 days. And then those teachers will be assessed on their training. Mm-hmm. So there'll be an objective person going, that seemed to work really well, that didn't work quite so well. And then also getting feedback from the kids. And the kids, this is the interesting one, the kids will then be followed up 3 years later to assess things like well-being, anxiety levels, depression levels, and so on. And then the Wellcome Trust went back to Oxford, who are kind of heading that one up, said, actually, we want to follow them up until they're 30.
Oh, wow.
Which is interesting. Yeah. so no pressure. 8-week course, 30 years later. Not 30 years later, but you know, when they're 30. So that's phase two. And then the third one is really around how you go about effectively implementing mindfulness in schools. You know, what's the most sustainable model and what works well and what are the hindrances. And so it's pretty comprehensive, you know, and lots of people involved. We had a big meeting about a week ago where there was this massive round table and about 50 people sat around, you know, some really, and Mark Williams being one of them, some really eminent research, Sarah Jane Blakemore and Willem Kuyken, and just really important people in the world of research,
yeah.
All coming together just to kind of talk about what we were doing.
Fantastic.
Yeah, exciting times.
Yes.
When we spoke with Lord Richard Layard, we, you know, we spoke of a 75-year Harvard study. It went in depth to identify what were the key factors in determining whether a child would later on in life be happy and be satisfied with the quality of their life. And they had factors such as academic grades, you know, wealth, you know, how rich and where they stood in the socioeconomic scale, and also the quality of their relationships. And, you know, time and time again, and not only with this Harvard study, but, you know, with independent studies that were done again and again, it's the quality of the relationships, which was the best indicator later on as to, you know, whether they would live a fulfilled and satisfied life.
And their emotional well-being.
Exactly.
Emotional well-being. Yeah. I mean, we're social animals, aren't we? We need to connect. And actually what seems to happen when we're... Well, funny enough, I was writing an article today about things like the use of social media, which I love. You know, here we are doing a Skype and it's really magical. And but at the same time, one of the things that I notice in my own daily work is that it's very isolating. Mm-hmm. You spend your time staring at a screen. It's quite isolating. And when you finally connect with people, you physically notice the difference. Mm-hmm. So it's not surprising at all that you know, people thrive on relationships. And certainly there's been research around mindfulness and the extent to which things like compassion practices make a huge difference to your reported experience. Yeah. Likewise, gratitude, you know, expressing gratitude to other people and other things makes you feel so much better. Yeah. So it's that kind of moving out of yourself and moving outwards and connecting is so, so important, really important.
Well, on that note, for students that are listening to this, can you go through some of the benefits that you're aware of that you've seen?
Okay, so I suppose the most common responses we get are, I really enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm. It was really nice way to spend my time. We're talking about the 8-week course, right?
Well, with the kids who've done, say, the Dot B course,
yeah,
or even the Pause B course, they're both kind of 8-9 weeks. Mm-hmm. And the most common reports, I really enjoyed it. It was a really nice way to spend my time, you know, once a week, whatever it was. So that's the first basic one, and nearly all of them say that. Mm-hmm. And that's great. And then the next thing they tend to say is it's really helped me with anxiety. So a lot of kids are reporting being very anxious around exams. You know, they're under so much pressure now to perform from a really early age. And they all really notice how mindfulness practices that they learn, their little kind of toolbox of mindfulness techniques can help them with that. And things like performance anxiety, anytime they're having to stand up in front of a group of people.
So confidence.
Confidence, mm-hmm. Yeah, managing anxiety. They talk about how they manage their own reactivity. So a lot of them have talked about, you know, arguments they get into, you know, brothers and sisters really annoying them, arguments with parents, and actually now having techniques where once they might have just kind of hit out or lashed out or shouted back, now they've got techniques where they can just really give themselves a little bit of space to just kind of assess the situation and then go back in and perhaps respond rather than react. Mm-hmm. Another thing they tend to talk about is noticing their mind telling them stories. So later in both Pause B and Dot B and the adult course, we talk about the storytelling mind. Yeah. And how your mind will naturally make things up in the absence of the full picture or enough information. Yeah. It will make up stories for you. Yeah. And very often those stories will be great, but more often than not, they will also be quite negative because your mind has evolved to kind of be prepared for difficulty. So if it's going to imagine a scenario, it's usually the worst case scenario. Yeah. So we all, you know, let's say you get a text or an email and it says, I need to talk.
Yeah.
And your mind goes, bing, and off you go. You know, you're imagining why and what might happen and is that person going to die and, you know, what's, have I done something terrible, rather than, oh, that's interesting, I wonder why they want to talk.
Yeah.
You know?
And all the while you're sort of having the same stress responses as if the news was actually true. And actually, yeah, well, we don't know.
We don't know. Yeah. But it's that fight or flight mechanism, isn't it? It just kind of kicks in so quickly.
Yeah.
So when we're talking about the storytelling mind, we give them some techniques and some practices they can do. When they notice that kind of anxiety coming up, we encourage them to identify where in their body they might actually notice that. And then have a strategy to go, hang on a second, before we go into fight or flight, let's just ground ourselves.
Yes.
And then go back and go, okay, so what is the fact here? You know, the fact is I've had a text and someone has said, can we talk? Mm-hmm. That's it. That's the fact.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nothing else.
Yes.
So everything else that I've got just gone through is a story that my mind has told me. And it might be true, but it might not be, you know. And I think we've all been in that situation, haven't we, where we've kind of wasted valuable energy, mental and physical, anticipating or worrying about something that might happen. It's like the Mark Twain quote, you know, some of the worst events in my life never actually happened.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with that one?
Yeah, well, it's like, you know, the analogy that we use is like going to the gym. The thought of going to the gym is way worse than actually being in the
way
gym
worse.
Itself.
Yeah. The dentist, the gym, yeah, exams, all of that.
Yeah.
Usually much worse because the mind's going, let's just really prepare for the worst case scenario here and then we'll feel okay.
Yeah. Is there a lot of emphasis on the science behind the mindfulness? I mean, I checked on the website. There were a few sections. I didn't find much about that. But is that something that is focused on? For example, the idea of this fight and flight part of the brain, the amygdala, that back in the days, I call it, where... you know, we did need to be vigilant of of all our external surroundings, and we needed to always be aware for snakes and spiders and bears and lions, because at any moment, you know, if we made the mistake to see a stick and, you know, to see a snake and mistake it for a stick, then, you know, the one time that we do make that mistake, it could be fatal, and therefore, you know, the end of your genes. And as a result of this, we're primed to always be aware and to be on edge and to look out, and that's helped us get to this evolutionary point. But the society that we live in today, we needn't be so on edge and so afraid. And because of that, we are kind of manifesting the same feelings and emotions in, like you mentioned, the email from a colleague or the text from a girlfriend or some guy giving me a dirty look or someone cutting me off in traffic. Those situations now replacing those old feelings. And because of that, we are living in stress.
And they trigger the same responses.
Exactly.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the reasons we think that there's such a prevalence of things like heart disease, apart from kind of, you know, lifestyle issues and diet. There's also this sense of, you know, stress-related illness being so common. And it's because our systems aren't equipped to deal with the kind of stresses we're dealing with. You know, that our ancestors in your description of, you know, the snake or whatever it is, the saber-toothed tiger, our bodies are brilliantly equipped to deal with that kind of life-threatening stressor. But of course, what we don't have nowadays, if we're very lucky and we live in a kind of safe environment, kind of Western industrialized country, is that constant threat of something really life-threatening.
Yeah.
So what our systems do instead is they fixate on the smaller stresses, the daily stresses.
Yep.
But we haven't evolved fast enough, I think, really, to change how we respond to them. So, yeah, every time you can't find your keys, the body is saying saber-toothed tiger. Every time, that's, you know, every time the phone rings and you think, oh God, that's the person I don't want to talk to, your body says, oh, saber-toothed tiger. So we get exhausted, you know, we literally stew in our own juices, our own kind of all those chemicals that pump around the body all the time, preparing us for fight or flight. We're just sitting there stewing in them because we don't get any downtime, we don't get any rest, because those kind of stresses never go away, do they? You know, time and work and family and email and all that other stuff. They don't go away like the saber-toothed tiger would go away. Particularly in Pawsby, actually, there's a whole lesson on the amygdala and fight or flight. And the really key thing there is that the amygdala doesn't think, it just reacts.
Yes.
You know, it's got to work really quickly to prepare us for fight or flight in life-threatening situations.
Yeah.
But of course, then... But there's this great film clip, it's a spoiler really, but there's this great film clip we show of this little boy running around, being chased by a huge flock of chickens. And they're all chasing after, he's only a little boy, and he's running. And you realise the reason they're chasing him is he's got this huge bag of breadcrumbs in his hands. And he just keeps running and running, doesn't drop the breadcrumbs. And you just know, if he just dropped the breadcrumbs, he'd be fine. But as a result, he's terrified, he's completely in flight mode. And it's just a really great illustration. When your amygdala is working, you're not thinking. And actually what you need to do is slow things down enough. So slow down the physical response, reconnect your prefrontal cortex so it can do some thinking for you. And then you go, oh, look, it's the breadcrumbs. I'll drop the bag and then it's all fine. Yeah, so they learn a lot about that stuff. And we've got some great great experiences of children using it in real life, you know, going, oh my goodness, that was my amygdala, wasn't it? It's like, okay, my prefrontal cortex is working now, you know.
Well, an interesting point which is very similar to that is the reasoning behind addictions. And I was really surprised to find out that, you know, the reason why addictive behaviour is so prevalent in society today is that it's one of the techniques that humans have evolved and developed throughout evolution. For example, eating food and, you know, having sex and enjoying yourself. When people do too much of that today, it's seen as an addiction and seen as something negative. But in fact, evolutionarily speaking, you know, those that did indulge and those that did, you know, it was always in the brain. And that's the reason why, you know, with the species has evolved so far. So when you get introduced to concepts like that, it's like, oh, it's really interesting to understand, because it can help reframe and restructure your perception and, you know, on some of the ideologies and philosophies that have been concrete in your life.
Yes.
Mm.
And just a little bit of education, you can say, wow, now I understand why.
It's quite freeing as well, you know, especially if it's around behaviour that you feel you can't control, to understand why that's happening and that it may have, in evolutionary terms, have a really good reason behind it. It doesn't necessarily excuse it, but at least you're kind of able to separate yourself away from it a little bit.
Yeah.
And it's not because you're a bad person or you have no control. Mm-hmm. It's because, you know, this is how we've evolved. Yeah. And then you can have some techniques that will help you maybe manage it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Since we last spoke, you know, Anne and I have had, you know, many conversations with some great minds on mindfulness, and one of the things that we've noticed, and the general theme, is that regular practice of mindfulness actually helps to develop happiness. Just the regular practice, you know, you're triggering off the same parts of the, you know, the brain, where the reward centers are for, you know, for helping other people or for feeling happy. And you know, I guess in the way that your course is laid out, it doesn't necessarily, you know, promote happiness as an end result. I see the word mentioned several times, but ultimately, you know, one of our main purposes in life is, you know, not only to be happy, but to help other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that for me personally, doing the meditative and the mindfulness practice, it is actually making me happier. You know, is that something that you could speak to? Is that something that you're seeing?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the reason we don't talk a lot about happiness per se is that, well, twofold really. It's one of a whole range of things I think you can explore and acquire through practice. And the word we tend to use is flourishing.
Yes.
Because, mm-hmm. you know, you can be flourishing but not happy. You could be flourishing and excited, you could be flourishing and calm, so that it's more complex, I think, than just happiness.
Yeah.
And also, I think if you hone it down to one thing too much, you're a little bit pandering to those people who say, oh, you're part of the kind of happy clappy crowd, you know, you just want to have some kind of utopian existence where you lose touch with reality. Of course, that's not true.
Yeah.
Happiness, of course, is something we're all trying to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a lot of people out there who misunderstand what meditation and mindfulness involve think you're somehow transporting yourself to another, you know, you're kind of, you're levitating and transporting yourself to some nirvana-like existence. And certainly some of the backlash press, and, you know, there's been a lot of it recently, I don't know if you've picked up on it, has been around, you know, either, what's the point of mindfulness? It makes you empty your mind. Or what's the point of mindfulness? It makes you transport yourself to somewhere beautiful. And that just, you know, means you can't connect with the real world. Usually it just shows a lack of understanding and certainly no experience of what mindfulness does. Because it's not about emptying your mind. It's about actually working more skillfully with your mind. And also it's about not transporting yourself somewhere else. It's about very much being here. What's here? But it's interesting, isn't it? That word happy is quite loaded, I think, for some people.
I guess there are many definitions as to what the word happiness is, but like I said, just being able to quiet down those amygdala voices, like we said before, you know, even that itself, I mean, once you can remove that out of your life, then there's just like this, you know, there's this path for you to you know, to explore other aspects of living a content and happy life.
Yeah, and actually in a funny sort of way, not necessarily getting rid of the amygdala response, because you won't, because it's just built in, but actually changing your relationship with it. And actually it's quite amusing, you know, sometimes you watch yourself having a bit of a fight or flight response and find yourself going, ooh, look at that! Hello!
<Yeah.
laughs> What's going on here then?
But that's the beauty of it, because once you can catch yourself doing that, and you go, I've now just changed a negative situation into a positive situation.
Yeah, and doing it with that, curiosity.
But not only that, but acknowledging, I've just realised what I've done. You know, I've just done that, and that's rewarding, and it's like, it's like a snowball effect. You do it, and
And that's the whole idea of metacognition, mm-hmm. you know, this idea that there's thinking and then there's noticing the thinking. And the noticing of the thinking is A, really interesting, and B, quite amusing sometimes. Mm-hmm. But most importantly, I think, kind of quite freeing. It's yes. like you're not caught up in your thoughts anymore. You're noticing the mishmash of thoughts.
And that's, for me, one of the hardest things to really explain to someone at first when I've had so many thousands of conversations with people and stuff. Well, what is mindfulness? What is meditation? Is it just being...
And what do you say? Because I still can't answer that question.
It's such a difficult question, but you know, regardless of what is said, it's that point where they're able to, you know, that almost that non-dualistic attitude where you can separate yourself from your thoughts. And the minute you can do that, there's so many profound effects that take place. Like, you know, I'm too skinny, or I'm not good enough, or I'm not worth it, or, you know, no one likes me, or I'm no good at my job, and this and that. Mm. Once you realise that these are just thoughts, and you do your daily practice, and it's like, oh, this, it's like almost like a movie screen. You have these thoughts that pop up, and, you know, once you're in a position to, I can see that this is not me anymore, this is almost separate.
Yeah.
And once you can do that, you take your breath, and then that goes away. It's like, well, it starts to beg the question, well, who is this person underneath it all?
That's a bigger question.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are so many deeper levels that, you know, really once you get into the flow of it and you start to explore it, that's why I feel the real kind of, you know, I don't like to use the word spiritual. I don't like to, but that is, you know, for me personally, where that kind of growth can take place.
Yeah, it's really transformative. Yeah. And one of the most rewarding parts of the teaching we do is around difficult thoughts, I think. Well, you would describe clouds and cinema screens, and we talk about thought buses.
Yeah.
Did we talk about this last time? I can't remember.
Not the thought buses, but we did talk about clouds. Yeah.
Yeah. So the idea is that, you know, you're there at the side of the road and a bus comes along, and it might be a really lovely party bus, you know, like a kind of adventure bus, but it might also be a bus with a really difficult thought attached to it, and you're very easily tempted on board, and then you're taken off for a ride, and the next thing you know, you're 8 miles down the road, you know, consumed in worry. Yeah. And what's lovely is actually just teaching techniques where you can just stay at the bus stop.
Yeah.
You know, the bus pulls up, you go, well, I could get on, or I could just stay here at the bus stop. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes three buses will come along at the same time, because that's what buses do, and you go, I'm going to stay at the bus stop. Yeah. It's really lovely. And I think we've had a few examples of kids who've had very difficult lives at home and, you know, horrible things going on. And they've come back and said, oh, I've had a really bad night last night. And you would say, well, oh, that's awful. But, you know, so how did you manage that situation? They say, I just stayed at the bus stop.
Yes.
Which is great.
So do you still meditate?
Yeah, I do.
I ask that question to all my guests because I'm very, you know, because it's almost a personal battle for me every day. To, you know, I said, am I going to do it at the same time every day, or am I going to do it when I find time, and I end up missing a couple of days, and like, you know, all these thoughts. So, you know, what's your meditation diary like?
I know myself well, and I know a bit like doing any kind of exercise. Actually, if I don't do it first thing in the morning, it won't happen.
Yeah.
And luckily, I'm a morning person. Okay. So I get up, I go downstairs, I have a drink of water. And then on my way back up to get dressed, I go into this separate room, which I associate with sitting.
Yes.
And I sit. And it will be between 20 and 40 minutes, usually. And then it's done.
Mm-hmm.
And then obviously, during the rest of the day, I kind of just try and pause and, you know, maybe do a kind of a breathing space or whatever, or an eating practice. But, And I notice the difference if I don't do it.
Okay.
The quality of my day really shifts if I don't do it. So I do it all the time. The funny thing is, when I then have to do it leading courses and things, so I'll do an evening course on a Tuesday, and I'm there in the evening thinking, this is absolutely the wrong time for me to be doing a practice. But I've got to lead a group of people in this practice. So that's interesting, actually. That's very interesting.
It's another thought in your mind.
I think that's the hardest thing, isn't it? The hardest thing about mindfulness is actually sitting down and doing it. Because the practices themselves aren't hard.
Yeah.
It's just the sitting, getting your bum on the cushion or the seat or wherever you do it, just sitting down.
Yeah. Like I said, the thought about it is a lot a lot more difficult than the actual practice itself.
Yeah, so right, notice that thought bus.
Exactly. So if I'm a teacher interested in mindfulness, and I want to find out more how I can get into it and how I can apply it in my classes, what's the best the best protocol? What's the best way for me to do this?
Well, you can certainly get in touch with us, mindfulnessinschools.org, and we can advise you.
Yeah.
And we all said at the beginning, we always say your first instinct might be to try and find a way to provide it for the kids. Our instinct is to say, if you want this to last longer than one course, then start with staff.
Sure.
And just, you know, the benefits to staff is immeasurable. Just in terms of their own well-being, you know, if you want to get kind of mercenary about it, it's also about, you know, staff absence levels due to ill health drop down, efficacy in teaching increases, imaginative, creative teaching increases, all those lovely things that you hope a school would have.
Yeah.
But most importantly, you know, the teachers learn more about mindfulness and more about how to take care of themselves. And from there, then you can start looking at the kids having some lessons.
All right. Well, it's very inspiring to talk to you and, you know, the work that the organisation, you know, Mindfulness in Schools Project and the Pause.B and the Pause and the .B project, you know, going into schools, you know, speaking with all the scientists and the experts to get the curriculum, to get the source material in place, and to see the amazing results. It's you know, it's being the change that we want to see, and you know, thank you very much for the work that you're doing.
Brilliant, thank you, and thanks for the work you're doing.
All right,
thank you.
All right, have a wonderful evening. Take care.
You too. Take care. Bye.
Take care. Bye bye.